during the uprisings of 2009, New York Times correspondent Nazila Fati fled her native Iran, fearing for her life. She had spent her career chronicling the country's contradictions. While the revolution provided women with greater access to education, their movement in civil society was regulated to the extreme. While the government pushed to be one of the first countries in the Middle East to provide internet access, it limited speech. Eventually, the government took notice of Nazila Fati's reporting. They tapped her phones, had her followed, and even hired her nanny as an informant. We'll hear Nazila Fati's personal and political perspective on life in Iran since the 1979 revolution, after the news from NPR. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's here. Thank you again for making Midday part of your day. Welcome to our second hour. In her book, The Lonely War, One Woman's Account of the Struggle for Modern Iran, Nazila Fati tells of growing up during the 1979 revolution and becoming a journalist in a country where free speech, the press, and women's rights were constantly threatened. The Lonely War weaves the personal story of Nazila Fati's coming of age and her ascent to New York Times correspondent with the political and social upheaval of the Islamic Revolution and the years since then. Nazila Fati was correspondent for The Times in Iran. She's reported on Iran's turbulent political climate for foreign policy, Time magazine, and other international publications. Her book, again, The Lonely War, is published by Basic Books. Nazila Fati, nice to have you on the Midday Show.
Thank you so much, Dan, for having me.
I don't usually start with what's the title of your book mean? But in this case, I think I'm going to. It's such an interesting account covering such a long period of time and so much turbulence and so many changes in your own life. But the title, The Lonely War, what does that refer to?
Well, that's supposed to refer to a lot of wars, a lot of battles that Iranians have waged by themselves. It starts with what happened after the revolution, the bloodshed and the violence. And then 8 years of war with Iraq, which was quite a lonely war for Iranians because they were being oppressed by the Islamic regime. And then almost the entire world had isolated Iran. And then after the war, other wars came along. Iranian women have always been waging a war for their freedom against the Islamic Republic. Women are practically the only group in Iran that they have not given in without a fight. And then, of course, the activists who have just continued their struggle for a democracy.
So all these little wars within a long struggle over a 40-year period.
Almost.
Yeah, almost. Nazila, thank you again for being here today. I want you, if you don't mind, we'll go back to where you were in 1979, what life was like for you then, because I like to talk about the revolution a bit, and then we'll talk about modern Iran today. And I also invite our callers to call in with questions that you might have about Iran. A couple of the reviews of your book have said this is a great book for Americans to understand, to get a better understanding of what life in Iran is like today and what it has been like since the revolution. So go back for me to your middle-class life in Iran as a young girl prior to the revolution of 79.
Well, that's true. I mean, before the revolution, I went to an American school, a private school, which very much felt normal to me. That was the kind of normal life that I knew. I dressed any way that I wanted. We studied Persian and English at our school, and education came first. And then what I realized after the revolution was that first, I couldn't go back to my school because all private schools were shut down and everybody had to go to public schools. But then we also had to dress differently, not just by wearing uniforms, but as a girl, I had to wear a headscarf and what felt like a very ugly coat. We had to wear these long, loose coats to cover our body.
The manteau?
They called them manteau. They borrowed it from the French word manteau. And over pants that had quite ugly elastic bands. As their waist, there was nothing attractive in what we had to wear, especially for a 9-year-old girl that was used to wearing just comfortable clothes.
You say in the book that you remember your mother saying to you and your sister, before going to school one day, if anyone asks you if your parents support the revolution, and maybe at the age of 9, you don't understand even what that's all about, or maybe you did. I don't know. Did you understand what she meant?
Yes. Unfortunately, my mother asked us to lie. But by that time, we had realized how necessary it was to lie, because within days after Khomeini's return, I remember picking up the newspaper and seeing horrifying images of people who had been executed. And then we heard and saw people around us who were taken to prison. So when my mother asked us the first day we were going to school, and that was about 6-7 months after the victory of the revolution, when she told us to be careful about what we said and how we answered questions, my sister and I were very aware of the consequences of a wrong thing that we could say at school.
And of your father, please tell us about him. What was he doing before the revolution, and what became of your father after the revolution?
Well, my father worked for the Ministry of Energy before the revolution. He had studied in England, but he had returned to Iran, was very excited about developments that were going on under the Shah. He was in charge of the ministry's work in northern Iran after we returned to Iran, that expanded the electric grid. He was responsible for connecting remote villages, factories, to the electricity grid. And he was very excited because my parents recalled their own childhood with a lot of sadness. They remembered how poor Iran was then, how education was hard, not accessible for everybody. It was hard for people in the villages to go to schools, even to commute to larger towns and to the cities. So what was happening was an era of development. My parents never supported the revolution because they thought it would interrupt the process that the country was going through. And of course, after the revolution, many people were disillusioned, even those who had supported the revolution. My father continued his work for about a year, but then he was sacked. It was part of the cleansing that the revolutionaries started at the civil sector. They started getting rid of people who were not loyal to the revolution because they wanted to replace them with people who supported Khomeini and the Islamic regime.
And your father didn't support it.
Absolutely
but,
not.
But what were the consequences of that for him?
Well, he had to quit a job that he had worked all his life for. He was 50 years old, and by that time, it was very hard for him to find work in any other civil sector. The government was the largest employer in the country. He started a small business on the side, but he didn't have any experience, so it didn't work. He lost a lot of money. And then he turned to an orchard that we had in northern Iran, in northwestern Iran, close to the border with Turkey. He had inherited the orchard from his father, and he started working there. So he drove about 400 miles there, stayed there for months, and worked on the orchard himself. When he returned, his skin was often peeling, wasn't in a good shape, but we were happy because compared to what was happening to other people, disappearing, getting killed, losing their homes and their properties, this was the least that my family was going through.
You managed to, or your parents managed to keep your home?
We kept
our home. Despite that change in your father's employment?
Yes. No, my father had fortunately paid off our apartment before the revolution.
When you were a girl going to school during that time, did you ever feel threatened by all of this? Maybe you were intimidated or scared, but did anyone ever question you or your sister about your loyalties?
All the time.
Oh, all the time?
All the time. It wasn't just us. Everybody.
You mean every day at school?
Almost
there would be questions?
Or? It wasn't. And, you know, there was a majority of people that looked at each other, and we knew we were lying. There was a minority that kept on pounding us with the government propaganda, and we had to respond to them in the same language. Whether they knew we were lying or not, I don't know. Gradually, they changed, too. But that was the cliche. That was the kind of answer we had to give them, and that's what we gave them. Hmm. I didn't feel guilty because that was a strategy to survive.
What did you think about the United States? And what were you told about the United States? Well, actually, I think we know, I'm assuming Americans remember and know what Iranians were told about the United States, the great Satan, right? How much of that did you hear? Was that as frequent as the rest of the propaganda? And what was your impression of the United States as a young girl?
Well, Dan, I had to go to school half an hour early every morning, and this was true about all public schools in the country. Whether it was hot or it was cold or it was snowing, we had to stand in a line every morning for the morning ceremony and chant death to America, death to Israel, death to England, all the countries that the regime wanted to consider as an enemy. And we did it. But those words didn't have any meaning for us. It was part of the morning ceremony.
Can you think back? I mean, it's hard to think back through memory and time. What you thought of the United States as a young girl? I mean, did you get images from television of the U.S. and did you have a general impression of this country, or did your father? I wonder what your father and mother might have said about it.
Well, my father had visited the United States. My uncles lived in California, and so did my cousins. So for me, it was a place where family lived. And when they visited us with a lot of gifts. A lot of good things came from there. We sometimes made our orders to. I mean, we asked them to bring the specific Nike shoes that were in fashion. So, I mean, America was a land of opportunities, good things. All the stuff that we wanted to wear came from the States. I never had any hostile feelings towards the United States, never believed what we were hearing at school. And there were tons of jokes that people were making about that whole idea of Great Satan, which country is the Great Satan and which country is the Small Satan. And I hardly ever came across anyone whose ideas ever went beyond the words that were chanted.
We're going to take our first break here and then talk some more, okay? Nazila Fati is our guest in this hour of midday. Her book is The Lonely War, One Woman's Account of the Struggle for Modern Iran. More of our conversation when we get back. And as I said before, any questions you might have about Iran for our guests in this hour, we would welcome them. You can reach us locally at 410-662-8780. Toll-free long distance, good from anywhere in the country, 866-661-9309. You can also submit a question by email, midday@wypr.org, and we're on Twitter at @MiddayWYPR. And welcome back to the Midday Show. Dan Rodericks here. Nazila Fati, our guest journalist, who's worked as a translator, of course, a commentator on Iran, now author of The Lonely War, One Woman's Account of the Struggle for Modern Iran. You worked for the New York Times from 2000 or 2001 until 2009. Is that about right?
That's right.
And before that, you had worked as a journalist as well.
Yes.
Yeah. We'll get to that in a moment. I want to ask you this question because I think your book is sort of the goal of the book is to increase Americans' understanding of, in particular, understanding of Iran. What is the most common, I guess the most common question you get from Americans about life over there today or during your time there? Because you haven't been there since 2009, right?
That's right.
What's the most common question you get, or maybe what do you think is the most common misunderstanding Americans have about Iran?
Well, there are a lot of them, I'm not surprised. I have misunderstanding about other countries as well. But one question that I get a lot, every time there's a forecast of snow, people ask me, do you know what snow is? Or when it snows, people ask me, have you ever seen snow? And I have to explain that not only it snows in Iran, we have ski resorts in Iran. We have some of the best ski slopes in the world. But, I mean, the question is only emblematic of how people know very little about this country. And how little they know that the country has changed. In the past 35 years, since the revolution, when the country has been quite isolated, Iran has changed dramatically. The majority of people live in urban areas. Iran is a very, very well-off country where a lot of the population is middle class. Education levels are very high, also among women. More than half of university students have been women since 2000.
And is the American impression very different from that what you get from people who ask you questions about Iran? They think, you know, there's a lot of poverty, for instance, or it isn't very advanced society?
Well, when I give talks and there are people who have visited Iran in the past, especially before the revolution, they always ask me why I talk the way I talk about Iran. They always ask about people who live in the villages and remote areas. And they question my analysis regarding people's education levels because they cannot believe that the urban middle class population is so large in Iran. Hmm. And this is something that happened after the Iranian revolution.
Is it because it is an assumption that it's a repressive society?
It is repressive, that is true. But the truth is that before the revolution, the rural population was much larger. And those people were very much disconnected from life in the cities because there weren't roads, because they didn't have television, because they didn't have electricity.
Did they start to feel empowered after the revolution?
Immediately.
You speak of the nanny in your house?
Yes.
Is it your nanny or a housekeeper?
Yeah.
Her name was Nessa. Nessa the housekeeper. And you noticed a change in her after the revolution.
Yes. Nessa was an example of that class for me. She lived in a tiny, tiny room very far away from the city before the revolution. When I visited her her room, I couldn't believe that she could sleep there with all her children. I mean, there was practically not enough space for them to lie down. But after the revolution, because her daughter had supported the revolution and had been very active, they were given what was called then revolutionary housing. She was given a two-bedroom house that had a kitchen, had a bathroom. Until then, they had to go to the public bath. They didn't have a kitchen. There was just a hose in a yard that they shared that water with other people in that sort of communal housing.
Did she become... I mean, what was the result of this for her in terms of her attitude? I don't want to say radicalized, but did she... Did her personality change as a result of this in some way?
Hers did not, but I cannot say that about other people. Hers definitely didn't change. Hmm. She continued to work as a housekeeper for many other people in our neighborhood. I never met her daughter, but her daughter became the principal of a school, married a like-minded young man, and she was the true blue revolutionary who supported Khomeini. So, and my experience from other principals who came to my school was that they were very much the arms of the government at public schools to promote the government ideology and sort of were in charge of raising the generation that had to be devoted to the values of the regime.
I'm looking at a list of presidents of Iran, all since the revolution, from 1981 to the present, Akbar Rafsanjani, Ali Khamenei, Muhammad Khatami, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and Hassan Rouhani, who is the present president, right? So my question, my American question is, what is the relationship between these men and the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khomeini, or the Ayatollah? How does that work?
Well, all the ones that you named, except for Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, had a turban.
Right.
And so did, so does
That's right.
Khomeini.
So they...
All clerics.
They're all clerics, part of that. Okay. So I guess we're talking about that period of, 2005 to 13 of Ahmadinejad?
Yes.
Okay. I'm just curious about that period. And what about today?
Today, the president is Hassan Rouhani, who's also a cleric, a mid-ranking cleric.
Right. So, but how does it work, the government and religion? I mean, it's a big, broad question there, but I don't quite understand the dynamic.
Well, I think we have to go a little bit back in history. In 1979, when Khomeini became the charismatic leader of the revolution, part of it was because he claimed that he was the man of God. And there were many other socialist groups that had struggled against the Shah for decades before 1979. But then suddenly Khomeini emerged as the leader. And the reason behind that was because he was a religious man and he had managed to galvanize the masses who were by nature traditional and religious. And so when he came to power, They were his support base. He relied on them, and religion was one of the important pillars of the revolution, and also during the war, because he used religion as a reason to continue the war against Saddam. He called Saddam and the struggle as a war against infidels. But after his death in 1989, they couldn't find anyone who had his religious credentials to replace him. When they picked Ali Khamenei, he was a mid-ranking cleric, but there was no other option. So they picked him and they promoted him to the position of Ayatollah so that his rank would fit his senior position. But Khamenei did not feel comfortable working with other senior clerics. He knew that he would never earn their respect. So he started marginalizing many senior clerics that had helped Khomeini when he was alive and had very important positions. As he started alienating them, he brought in a lot of members of the Revolutionary Guards who were not part of the clerical establishment, and also many mid-ranking clerics who were not more senior to him. And somehow they had to depend on him. So Iran has changed a lot since Khomeini's death.
But these men were able to make the government function.
They did.
And there were elections.
There were elections.
So do elections really mean anything in Iran?
Well, they mean in a sense that people go to the polls every 2 years or every 4 years to pick between the candidates that have already been screened. There's a clerical body that screens everyone who wants to run in a public election. And if they pose any kind of threat, they can't run. They would be barred. So the elections are not democratic in a Western sense, but people get to choose, and they usually make a joke that they go to the polls to make a choice between the worst and the bad.
Right, the worst and the bad. You know, I guess I would say that was my American question. Because you look at it from the outside and wonder, how does government function with clerics in charge, with religion so immersed in the culture? But government does function. And the society during your time there and since has become become modernized, right?
Very much modernized.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's the $1 million question. Since the clerics came to power, my parents kept on promising me that they wouldn't be able to run the country, and so this regime is going to collapse. It hasn't in the past 35 years.
Yeah, your father didn't think it would last.
No, I mean, a lot of people didn't think that it would last. But it turned out that other than religious education, the clerics learned a lot of other things at the seminaries. And one of those things, apparently, is to get together, discuss things, and resolve things. It's not one man's opinion. So they do compromise, and they do trust bureaucrats who can run things for them.
Nazila Fati is our guest on Midday in this hour. The Lonely War is her book, published by Basic Books, One Woman's Account of the Struggle for Modern Iran. Someone else listening now may think, well, how did she do it? How did she go from this repressive time when she feared going to school and had to vow hatred of the great Satan, the United States, an atmosphere of fear and intimidation, certainly. But you grew up, you got educated, and then you became a journalist. You practiced, what we in this country call the First Amendment. So how did that happen?
Well, Dan, we learn to divide our life between a public space and a private space. In the private space, we did everything that we wanted to do. And the private space was like your home, my home, people's home, the space where we partied. We did all the things that the government banned us from. You were not allowed to dance. You were not allowed to watch movies. You were not allowed to do a lot of things. But in the private space, we tried to maintain a normal life. In the public space, which was where we met government agents, we came face to face with those who wanted to enforce the laws of the Islamic Republic. We handled ourselves the way that they wanted us, and in the meantime, we defied. I mean, when you look at the history of women's movement in Iran since the 1979 revolution, Iranian women never gave in to the obligatory veiling. I mean, there were always little things that they tried to defy, always show a little bit of hair, always make the coat a little bit tighter than how loose the regime wanted it to be. So we kept on pushing those boundaries back as well. And this is where Iranians are now. I mean, when you visit Iran, you are shocked at what the Islamic dress code has become. It is definitely not black anymore.
So what did you do in your private space toward a career? What were you thinking of, say, when you were, 17 or 18 years old? Were you thinking of what you wanted to be when you grew up?
Whether
that was possible in Iran?
Most Iranian parents want their children to become either engineers or doctors. So I also wanted to become an engineer or a doctor. But that changed when I watched the first group of Western reporters come to the country after Khomeini's death. And I was watching a press conference with my mother and how Ali Akbar Rafsanjani, the president that you mentioned, mm-hmm. he was the first president after Khomeini's death, how he tried to handle the questions that foreign reporters pose. It was very different than the way Iranian reporters were dealt with. And immediately, I wanted to become a journalist, too, and I wanted to work for Western media.
There came a time when you were working with Judith Miller of the New York Times. Is that right?
That's right.
You helped her as a translator, as a fixer of things. How did that relationship develop?
I was very lucky. I wanted to become a journalist, but I was more lucky than I could have imagined because another group of Western reporters came to the country in 1992 or 3. There was a huge earthquake in northern Iran, and thousands of people were killed. Iran needed international help and wanted reporters to write about the scale of destruction. So many reporters had come to the country, and the government didn't have enough translators for them. So some of them had contacted my French teacher, who was French, and they trusted her, asking for anyone who spoke English or French and could help them to translate. So she put me and two other friends in touch with a big group of reporters, and that's how we started out. All three of us started translating.
And so what impressed you was the way government leaders responded to Western journalists. Is that what it was, that they commanded respect? They actually answered their questions?
Well, the way he, Rafsanjani, dealt with local reporters was quite dismissive. I mean, gave the same answers we had heard for almost 10 years. But then when it came to answers to foreign reporters, especially Western ones, it was very obvious that he wanted to send a message that this is going to be a different era for Iran after Khomeini's death. And one of the most interesting reactions was that when, I think it was Geraldine Brooks, and she worked for the Wall Street Journal back then, she came to the podium to ask a question, and she was wearing a head-to-toe chador. She was very well covered, and this was what Iranian women were encouraged to wear. But then suddenly Rafsanjani turned around and said to her, "Why are you wearing this instead of a simple headscarf?" And this was not what we had heard. We had heard that the ideal cloth for a woman was the head-to-toe black chador. It was very obvious to everyone that he was sending a message not only to the outside world but also to Iranians inside the country that this is going to be a very different country after Khomeini's death.
So fortuitous timing for Nazila, interest in journalism, maybe, right? Getting the bug for that, working a little bit with Judith Miller, and then this president who's sort of sending a different message to Iranian journalists that maybe this is things are going to loosen up here a little bit.
Absolutely.
And did they? Did press reporting of the regime change after that? What would you say about it? It did?
Yeah, okay. It did change. I mean, one of the biggest changes was that instead of the black headscarf, we started wearing smaller, lighter floral ones.
What about in terms of what you were able to report on or the local press was able to report on and say and comment on?
Yes, it changed. After Khomeini's death, suddenly we were faced with publications that were relatively, everything is relative in countries like Iran, were more liberal. They were questioning the government. Actually, they started writing about corruption, which wasn't very common before Khomeini's death.
Was there censorship of the press?
There had always been censorship. But
That goes back to the Shah's time, right?
It was even worse under the Shah.
Yeah.
It became a little bit better after the revolution, immediately after the revolution, when the Islamists took power. They cracked down on free press again. But after Khomeini's death, it became a lot better. And it started with questioning what was happening inside the country. I can't claim that they were democratic publications and they were free to write whatever they wanted. But it became relatively better. Usually how it works with publications inside the country is that there is more self-censorship than government censorship. Nobody sees the materials. So once they are published, they might get reaction from the government. Sometimes they were shut down and they had to start publishing under a new name.
Nazila Fatih, those years from what through the 90s into 2000 or so, what did you do primarily during that time?
During that time, I worked as a translator and fixer. What happened was that internet came to Iran very early on, and I got an email service. I didn't have internet yet because the internet was very expensive. I got an email service, which allowed me to send attachments, and I started sending memos to the reporters that I worked with as a translator and fixer. And so it enabled them to write stories, even if they were not in the country. And that helped me to get a job as a stringer in the Time magazine and the New York Times. Both of them put me on a retainer. So I became some sort of a reporter. But
you've written hundreds and hundreds of stories since those days.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then eventually a contract correspondent with the New York Times, right?
Yes.
Yeah. You're going to tell us about Mr. X? Okay, we'll take a break here. After the break, will you tell us about Mr. X?
Absolutely.
Your encounter with Mr. X. Nazila Fatih is with us. The Lonely War, One Woman's Account of the Struggle for Modern Iran is her book, published by Basic Books. Short break on Midday. Dan Roderick's here. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday here. I wanted to read one of the reviews of The Lonely War, just a piece of it, by Arnold Isaacs, writing in Cicero magazine. Arnold Isaacs, known to his former Baltimore Sun colleagues as Skip, says, "The struggle between Iran's different personalities continues," meaning today, of course, "with important implications for the Middle East and the rest of the world. But if it does not tell us how the struggle will end, Nazila Fatih's account is a useful reminder that the clash of beliefs and cultures is at its core a conflict within the Muslim world, not between Islam and the West. Americans are, of course, affected in a great many ways by that conflict, but they would do well to remember that winning or losing the war of ideas is not in American hands. A wise U.S. policy must begin with understanding that reality and the nature of the different forces involved. In this book, Nazila Fatih has made a valuable contribution to that understanding." So I thought you'd appreciate some flattering review there, but I was struck by the observation that about this clash of beliefs and cultures at the core being within the Muslim world. Could you tell us what's being addressed there? And I think you agree with that.
I totally agree with that. I think that's a very excellent observation. And what is interesting that the Islamic Republic has definitely lost the war over ideas. Iranians have just tried over the past 35 years, and this applies even to those who supported the revolution, to constantly struggle and define their own identities. So as a result, when you look at Iran as a nation now, the identity of Iranians is very much apart from the identity that the revolutionaries, the Islamists, wanted to impose on the people. And again, going back to the excellent analysis that you just read, nobody wins the war of ideas. It is people who define themselves based on the environment where they live and how they want to decide how they want to live. And this was the case with Iranians.
Well, I want to go back to your own story, Nazila, and ask you about Mr. X. And then we'll come back to some more of the conflicts that occur in the country. Let's talk about Mr. X. This was someone from the intelligence ministry in Iran. Now, you'd worked as a translator, journalist for a little while now, and you get a phone call or a visit from Mr. X?
Yeah, and I knew this call would come. So when it came, I was expecting it, but I was terrified, was really terrified. I was summoned to the Ministry of Intelligence. I had to fill out tons of papers. Then I was sent away, and they told me that somebody would contact me. And the person who contacted me was Mr. X. The first time I went, he was with somebody else. And they started playing good cop, bad cop. There was somebody who started screaming at me. And
for what? Was there a particular story that you'd written or some work you had done that set them off?
I hadn't written anything. I had just worked with Judith Miller.
As a translator.
First of all, he called me a traitor because I was working with foreign reporters. In his mind, foreign reporters were all spies and they all wanted to overthrow the regime. But then he started reading parts of an article that later I found out was Judith Miller's article about Iranian cinema. And he disagreed with it. And there was nothing wrong in that article. It was all true. But of course, the revolutionaries didn't like anything that showed a different picture of Iran. So he kept on screaming. I don't remember for how long.
Well, you were disloyal for having contributed to that work.
Having translated for somebody who presented a wrong image of Iran. I was terrified. I thought, oh my God, I'd be lucky if I can get out of this room with these guys. But then Mr. X stepped in. He was polite. And he was like the voice of reason who was inviting me to report if I see anything suspicious, that's all. But he kept on summoning me over the years, for 10 years exactly. And he, in the beginning, he was very intimidating. He wanted to know where I was going, what I was seeing, if there was anyone who was trying to spy. One thing that he was very sensitive about was if there were reporters who were coming to the country to conduct any kind of surveys. That was something that terrified them. And I had to explain that taking surveys is very complicated. This is not something that a single reporter would want to do. But over the years, he started becoming interested in my analysis. Like during the elections, he would call me and ask me what people were saying, which candidate was getting more votes. And then finally,
let me go back to the spy business there for a moment. He was sort of asking you to, spy on possible spies and report back to him.
Yeah, he...
What did you do with that? Did you say, okay, I'll do it, or I'm loyal to my country? What did you say?
Well, they came up with this, both of them came up with this long lecture how the West has always wanted to overthrow the Islamic regime since its foundation in 1979, that it's no secret that Westerners are sending spies into Iran to pursue that policy. And that a lot of journalists had come in as spies. I knew that American reporters could not work as spies. This was something that one of my colleagues had explained to me. But then when they were asking me to make sure to report to them if there was a spy among the reporters I was working with, I didn't argue with them. I was always sitting there quietly and saying, yes, sir, yes, sir. So when they asked me to spy on anyone who was a spy, I said, of course, Iran is my country, too. I don't want to see any kind of instability.
But in practice, you didn't actually do any of that.
I never came across anyone who seemed to be a spy.
And then you became a journalist in your own right.
Yes.
A reporter covering from Tehran or wherever the job took you for the New York Times. What was it like during those years in terms of, in terms of freedom, particularly being a female reporter trying to function in that society? What was it like for you?
Well, being a female reporter, even during the first decade when I started working and I didn't have press credentials, was always easier because Iranian society is very much divided between women and men. As a woman, I could enter women's world. I could go to, for example, the women's section at a mosque. I could go to the women's section at the Friday prayers. Members of parliament invited me to their home because they felt comfortable with me, whether they were women or they were men. But if a man wanted to go to a female member of parliament's home, that would have been almost impossible. So as a woman, I had access both to women's world and to men's world. And when I became a reporter, it became so much easier for me to write stories about, especially women's world, because they trusted me.
I bet there are people listening now, Nazila, who probably think, wait a minute, how could she do this? Weren't women told that they had to stay home? But that's not true in your society.
No. Women were not told to stay home. Actually, Khomeini encouraged women to leave their homes and come out. What he did was that he tried to get rid of upper class, higher class, women who did not support the revolution. He asked women from the lower classes to come into society to spread his message. And as a woman, as long as I had my headscarf on, or even sometimes if it was in something needed, I would take a chador with me. And nobody ever told me that you cannot be here because you're a woman.
Now, things, we mentioned turbulence. I mean, there's ups and downs in this story over the many years of Iran. But in particular, when we get to 2009, so what's called the Green Revolution. So please remind our listeners about what that was, what set that off, and what was it like for you as a journalist during that time?
Well, as many of your listeners might remember, Dan, Ahmadinejad had become a face of embarrassment for Iranians. He wasn't just unpopular outside Iran. He was unpopular inside the country, too. The economy had turned into shambles under his presidency. Corruption and mismanagement had just peaked. And whatever he said, especially when he was traveling, was more like a joke. And Iranians were totally embarrassed to have him as a president. So during the 2009 election, people came out in huge numbers to vote for the other candidate to make sure that he wouldn't remain president. And what happened was that, first of all, on the day of the election, there were too many signs that they were rigging the votes. And then very early on, the government announced that he had won. So the next day, people poured out on the streets spontaneously. And it was a very emotional time because the number of people who came out on the streets and everybody was asking for new elections was just huge, millions of people.
So he was no longer seen as legitimate.
No, not at all.
Right.
And people were angry because this was the minimum right that they were given. They weren't choosing the president of their choice. They were trying to choose one of the candidates that the government had already approved.
Would you say that Iran became a police state again during that time?
Iran became a military state, absolutely.
Yeah. And how did that affect you in terms of the way you functioned as a journalist?
Well, 2-3 days after the vote, the government sent a letter to all resident journalists and asked us not to go out to cover the protests. I mean, they practically wanted us to turn a blind eye on what was happening on the streets. They asked visiting correspondents to leave the country. It was obvious that they wanted to hide the story, and they were embarrassed about what was happening on the streets. And, of course, we went out. We covered it. I started getting death threats. In the beginning, I didn't take them seriously. I thought it was part of government intimidation.
Death threats from people in the street who supported the government?
No, I had met a commander of the paramilitary besieged force during one of the protests. He was responsible for cracking down on the protesters. And later, I visited him at his office, so I knew who he was. He called me one day and he said that my picture was given to snipers and they had orders to shoot me if they saw me on the streets. But I thought he was trying to intimidate me. The story was really big and people were getting shot, but millions of people were still coming out. So I kept going out and I wrote about what I was seeing until one day when I was leaving my house and I noticed that there were 16 men outside my house, and I realized that I had come under surveillance.
16 men? 16 all visible men. To you, obviously.
All visible to me. Huh. I mean, I had to count them later on. But as soon as I pulled out of our driveway, I saw two men in a car across the street, then another car pulled up right behind me, and there were two men inside that car. And then as I drove on a bit farther, there were two motorcycles that they pulled up on both sides of my car, and there were two men on each.
You also had the disappointment of a sort of a spy in your own household, right?
Yes.
I'm speaking here of, is it Nasrin or Nasreen?
Yes, Nasreen. Yeah. She was our nanny and housekeeper. And she told us very early on when she started working for us that she had been kidnapped and asked to spy on us. And she said that she had refused to spy on us, which we didn't believe. I mean,
you think she was an informant?
Well, we are sure she was. And we weren't about her spying on us because I wasn't doing anything that was dangerous. I was doing my job.
You left Iran then?
Yes.
Understandably, you feared for your life. And then you went to Canada?
Yes.
And now you live here in Maryland?
Yes.
And now you've written a book called The Lonely War, One Woman's Account of the Struggle for Modern Iran by Nazila Fati. What is your hope for the U.S. and Iran? We just have a couple of minutes left together, and I wonder what your thoughts are about that today and here in 2015.
Well, my hope is that the nuclear talks will result in some kind of agreement. I hope that the standoff would end, and this would be a step toward rapprochement between the United States and Iran. I'm being realistic here, and I don't think that's going to come that quickly. But the nuclear fight has put a huge pressure on Iranian civil society. It hasn't put pressure on the government. The government has access to oil. It has found ways to smuggle its oil despite the sanctions and have the kind of revenue that it needs.
How has it pressured the society?
It has ruined the economy, and it has led to inflation, devaluation of Iranian currency. And it's just double pressure, another lonely war for Iranians.
And eventually you think this pressure will reach the top? And we may have something?
No, that's not going to happen.
No.
No. This is not a society that you can expect people to come out and stage another revolution.
In terms of the nuclear talks, though, you do have some hope there?
I am hoping that both sides would compromise and end this conflict, because it's not going to put pressure on the Iranian government to make any kind of huge compromise. And it's not going to lead to any kind of peaceful solution.
So it doesn't sound like there's a lot of hope there.
Unless there is some kind of settlement.
Nice to have you on our show today, Nazila.
Thank you so much, Dan, for having me.
Thank you for this book, recommended by reviewers for a better understanding of Iran, where it's been since 1979, where it is today. Again, The Lonely War by Nazila Fati. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. See you again soon.
Midday Senior Producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer is Maureen Harvey. The Associate Producer is Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Carrie DeSantis, David Richmond, and Marjorie Goodman. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Rogic's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.